We're talking about protest in this episode, and things have been really tense recently in Oakland, California. A scandal involving police officers and sex trafficking has led to the resignation of three police chiefs in 1 week, and protesters are putting pressure on Oakland's mayor to do more. Kat Brooks is the co-founder of Oakland's Anti-Police Terror Project. She's also an activist with Black Lives Matter, and she organized the latest round of protest following explosive revelations of police officers involved in the statutory rape of a young woman.
So Celeste Guap, she's now 18, but at the time she was 17, and she ran into a police officer as she was running away from her pimp, and he, in her words, saved her from the pimp, and they began a sexual relationship, which we call statutory rape. He then passed her around to at least 14 other officers in the Oakland Police Department, and they took sex in exchange for money and or information about bus and protection from her pimp. We know that the chief's wife knew about it, and so we assume that the chief knew about it. And so what we did was put red danger tape around the police station, and then we dropped a very big banner on the two OPD flagpoles that had the picture of a young woman of color with white hands covering her mouth that said OPD guilty as charged of statutory rape and human trafficking.
How did people, bystanders, passersby, respond to the protest?
Even though for a little while we were sort of blocking traffic a little bit, people were honking their horns and screaming right on and putting their fists out the window and clapping. I was a little taken aback by how invested the community was in holding OPD accountable for this crime. The other thing that was more alarming was that two women randomly walking by, one of whom broke down and said, "Where were you when this happened to me?" And that really struck us hard. And so we believe that there are more Celeste Guaps out there that we hope to find and heal and help and bring the officers who violated them to justice.
And you've been an activist in this area, specifically working on police violence for since 2009, right?
Yes.
Do you think the continued protests, you know, the one case after another in city after city, has changed the way different communities now deal with these cases when they're brought up?
Well, we've certainly seen that be the case in Oakland. You know, one of the things that we do when law enforcement kills someone is we send our first responders team out, and they talk to the people who were in the neighborhood over a couple of days period of time, and they collect information and they take pictures and witness statements and evidence. And we utilize that to create a people's narrative of what happened, which invariably is different from the state's, right? And we were able to successfully get the state to change its story in at least two cases. And so to us, while it didn't stop them from killing people, it definitely made them adjust their strategy, which was, you know, win one.
Well, I'm asking because we're talking about protest movements during this hour, and we've heard a few people say, including Micah White, one of the organizers of the Occupy movement, that in-the-street, old-fashioned protests don't work anymore, are not politically effective.
I absolutely disagree. Were it not for Ferguson, we would not be having this international conversation about police terror to the level it is. Were it not for Oscar Grant, we would not be having these conversations. We would be not talking about body cameras. We would not be seeing police officers getting arrested. I would not be sitting in this studio right now. Protest matters in terms of raising consciousness and forcing conversation that would otherwise go unhad. Where I would agree that it doesn't matter is if it is not coupled with old-fashioned door-to-door, you know, organizing, base building. It goes much further than screaming in the streets, but screaming in the streets adds the pressure that you need to make elected officials have a different conversation, and it attracts and awakes new folks into the movement.
I want to ask you about one specific tactic you've used, disruption, right? So Black Lives Matter has gotten the most criticism when it has been involved in very disruptive kinds of protests, you know, interrupting presidential candidates during speeches. It's a tactic you've used, too. I mean, you famously blocked a BART train for 2 hours as part of a big demonstration. So, I mean, tell me what you did and what you wanted to accomplish.
So again, in collaboration with a bunch of other amazing folks, Ruckus. That was the birth of our Black Lives Matter Bay Area chapter, Blackout Collective. We locked down the West Oakland BART train, which is the last stop between Oakland and San Francisco on the busiest shopping day of the year. And we did it in the name of Michael Brown. And our goal was to do it for 4 hours, which is the amount of time that he was left laying in the street. And while that was happening, this is the other piece people don't talk about. While we were doing that, there were over 200 Africans, Black folks, in the parking lot holding healing ceremony, pouring libation, praying for healing, doing energy cleanses. It was quite beautiful while we were engaged in the active resistance. And the message was clear, right? As long as you make America's business the business of killing Black people, there will be no business as usual. And we will continue to shut it down until something changes. And to our critics, of whom we have a lot.
Including some in the civil rights movement.
Even the NAACP, they couldn't wait to trot themselves out there and say something about it. You cannot appreciate the lunch counter sit-ins and say that we can't, you know, we shouldn't shut down BART. You cannot uphold Rosa Parks and demonize Alicia Garza. You cannot uplift the Panthers and criticize the Black Lives Matter movement of today. It's just, it's hypocritical. Power has never conceded. It's always needed interruption and disruption and pushback in order for change to come. And this is just the 21st century version of that. And it's working.
Why do you think people who are even on your side, though, are nervous about building bridges or, you know, accuse you of pushing away allies through disruptive protests like this?
Well, I think it's because we have a very different definition of what ally means. I think for the folks that are on our side or who look like us that are scared that we're going to make massa mad, right? They're thinking about funding and they're thinking about their position and they're thinking truly with a slave mentality, as opposed to thinking that, no, we need to be as unapologetic in our resistance as they are in their oppression. And kowtowing and tiptoeing to these fools has not gotten us anything but a 21st century version of slavery. And if you can't see that or you're not willing to see that, my bet is that it's because you're getting something out of the paradigm remaining as is, that you are actually not one of the thousands of Black people that is suffering under the boot of white supremacy inside of this country. Because if you were, you would be saying, I want to get liberated by any means necessary.
You know, listening to you, listening to your words right now is reminding me of this blistering speech you gave. I saw it on video. I think it was in front of the San Francisco Police Commission, in which you basically warned the police chief that the community was coming for him. And I watched that speech, that clip, and I thought, honestly, the first phrase that came into my mind was cleansing rage. I mean, first of all, it must be exhausting. But secondly, are you deliberate about how you use that rage, when you let it out, when you let yourself feel it?
That's a really vulnerable question. That particular night, I had no intention of speaking, to be honest. I was making space for some of the young Black sisters that are organizing in San Francisco. And as I watched those sisters go up and speak, and I watched people check their cell phones or their watches or clean their fingernails or whatever else they felt was more important than listening to the pain and trauma of these young Black women. I can't explain it. I just opened my mouth and out it came. But I think that I walk in rage a lot. If I walked in the pain and the trauma of what's happening to Black people in this country, to me, that's not sustainable, right? I wouldn't be able to move. I wouldn't be able to function. And that's no different than any other Black person in this country. You have to get up and move forward in spite of. And so we all have our vices or things that we run to. And so for me, the anger is the easiest to access. It's the most righteous to access and tends to be with what I lead with. That doesn't mean that I don't go home and cry deeply for my folks at night. But rage is sort of what pushes me through.
Do you feel like you're making progress?
Me, Kat, no. Us collectively as a people, yes. If I didn't, I couldn't keep on. You know, I've got a kid I don't see and jobs that I end up having to work at 1 or 2 in the morning because the movement doesn't pay me, right? It's just what I do. But, you know, the Panthers had an ideology that we actually aren't working for today. We're working for 7 generations from now. And that's what I keep in my head, that I'm not going to see, and I know that, I'm not going to see the kind of society I want to live in my lifetime. But if my great, 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 however many great grandchildren do, if even my daughter, if her generation experiences a slightly different America than we did, then it was worth it. And I believe that we're on the way there to that.
Kat Brooks. She's the co-founder of the Anti-Police Terror Project and a Black Lives Matter activist in Oakland, California.